ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
One liftoff.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and I looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it. It had exploded.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
1 year of Trump. The time to act is now, while we still can. That's the rather sobering and urgent headline of a piece this week by the fearless Russian-American journalist M. Gessen in the New York Times. But look, is it already too late to save American democracy? M. Gessen joins fellow world-leading scholars of fascism, Jason Stanley and Anna Funder, today on Big Ideas. Hello, welcome. My name is Natasha Mitchell, and on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, you get a front row seat to the best live events. And today we're at the Sydney Opera House's Talks and Ideas Day, Curious. Now, from Venezuela to Greenland to Minnesota, in his second term as United States President, Donald Trump, with his supporters, has really upended America and the world in ways that continue to shock, to surprise, and now terrify. Asking, is it fascism? M. Gessen, an opinion writer for the New York Times and author of 11 books, including Surviving Autocracy and the award-winning The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. M. Gessen has been sentenced by a Moscow court to 8 years jail for their reporting of the war in Ukraine. Jason Stanley is an American professor of philosophy and linguistics and best-selling author of 7 books, including How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Last month, Jason left Yale University to move to Canada, taking up a role as Chair of American Studies at the University of Toronto. And you'll hear more about that decision of his in a moment. And hosting this discussion, recorded live late last year, is Australian author of the acclaimed books Stasiland, All That I Am, and Wifedom, about the wife of George Orwell, the author of 1984, Anna Funder.
The theme of courage and conscience to speak out against autocratic regimes, whether in East Germany or under the Nazis or in patriarchy, has been my life's fascination. And it's a huge honour for me to be here with both of you today who have done and are doing just that. So Goethe, one of my favourite writers, the German genius, said in the early 19th century that nations, like human beings, are unaware of the workings of their inner nature, and ultimately, we are surprised, even astounded, at what emerges. So today we are here, all of us, to deal with our astonishment at what has emerged and is emerging in the US, and to bring clarity to the situation. So to start with, I thought I would ask you both a more personal question, if I may. You each come to your work from lived experience and family background of experience with authoritarian regimes, indeed fascist regimes. So I was wondering if you could perhaps describe in a way how you were born to be doing what you're doing. Masha.
So my grandmother was, I'm Jewish. My grandmother was born in Poland and ended up in the Soviet Union during World War II and survived quite by accident, by the accident of being in Eastern Poland, which was initially occupied by the Soviet Union and then reoccupied by Nazi Germany, by the accident of starting university in Moscow before the German occupation. Her father died in Majdanek. Her numerous cousins, aunts, uncles, basically this entire giant Jewish family perished in the Holocaust. And my first real book was about actually my two grandmothers, The other grandmother grew up in the Soviet Union, and it was called How My Grandmother Survived Hitler's War and Stalin's Peace. And what I was really interested in, and this is something that I keep being obsessed with, is sort of what happens in between the dates in the history books. Like, what happened in the ghettos before, between the time they were formed and the time they were liquidated? That's a lot of that first book was centered actually on that. Because that's not how we learn history. We learn history as completed facts, as events that occur once. And I think that this has never been more important, this sort of way of thinking about history, because a key concept that I'm thinking about now is genocide. And genocide as a legal concept is unique because it's a process. It's a crime that unfolds over time. And you can't understand that unless you think about history as something that doesn't happen on a particular date, but actually unfolds and changes over time.
Yeah, so Masha and I have somewhat overlapping backgrounds. My mother was born in, my grandparents were Polish Jews, very poor, impoverished Orthodox Jews in Chełm, from Chełm, and they went to Siberia when Hitler invaded Eastern Poland, and my mother was born en route and grew up in the Gulag, and then was repatriated back to Poland in 1945, where she met her father by accident on the Trans-Siberian Railway. And then when they got back to Warsaw, they discovered their whole family had been killed. So my great-grandmother was killed in Sobibor, all seven of my great-uncles and all of their children. And then my father grew up in Berlin, the sort of polar opposite of the shtetl Jew. His grandfather was the cantor, Oberkantor, of the largest Jewish congregation in Berlin at the Fasanenstrasse Synagogue. Goebbels personally gave the order to burn it. And then he came in late July 1939, arriving in New York City in early August 1939 with my grandmother to New York City. So I came from both of the German Jewish side and Polish Jewish side. And I also should say that my mother worked in Manhattan Criminal Court for 33 years. She worked as a court stenographer throughout the Central Park Five case. And she always said, they're going to kill all the black people here. So I had a sort of window into the capacities of the United States from my mother's dual experience of her childhood and what was happening in the United States with mass incarceration in the 80s and 90s.
So I guess that leads me, Jason, to ask you how much of that personal heritage, if it can be, it probably can't be separated, and then there's your intellectual work, has contributed to your decision to leave the States? Is it a gut feel from generations of leaving, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I have two black children, and so there's sort of my ex-wife is black American, and so that has always been my fear. The minute I had a son in 2011, but I didn't think of leaving specifically for that, though. But it was too much like my grandmother's account of Berlin in the 30s in her memoir, The Unforgotten. She says at one point in 1930, she was doing this underground work in concentration camps, dressed as a Nazi social worker. She was going into Sachsenhausen, rescuing people. And she says in her memoir, she was trying to convince people in 1937, Berlin Jews, that it was time to get out. And they're like, oh, come on, this will blow over. And so I understood that, you know, you can't, maybe things will be sort of okay, but the fact that people think that things are going to be okay is no evidence at all.
Masha, you've had to leave Russia on very short notice before, twice. Are you feeling similar emotions to then? I mean, your position in the US now as a trans person, you're under attack there. How is that feeling?
Yeah, it's a familiar feeling. And I recently wrote a column that was headlined, I Look at My Country and I See a Stranger, and this time I'm in the U.S. But yes, the feeling is familiar. I'm a little I think it's my job to doubt this feeling, right? Because familiarity can be deceptive, and just because something feels the same way doesn't mean it is the same thing. I think I can logically argue my way to absolute catastrophe in the United States. I also think that nothing in history is predetermined. And I think that the question, is it fascism yet, is very easy to answer. Not a complicated question, and not worth an hour of our time, actually. But the question, is what has happened in the United States irreversible? Is it going to lead to absolute catastrophe? We don't know that yet.
You don't know,
did we you? Don't know that yet.
Yes. I was just going to recap. We are all familiar with what's happened in the US. We are going to briefly ask the question, fascism, are we there yet? Because I think that's my job description.
That's okay.
For the day.
Humor you.
Humor me. And I just have this little list, not that long, it could have been a lot longer, of what a little recap of Trumpism since January, as he is rapidly dismantling democracy by abolishing, gutting, controlling or attacking institutions which protect it, both within government and in civil society. So I've just got two little lists, a government list, a civil society list, and then I'm going to ask you the question that I'm paid to ask you. In government, he has sent Elon Musk and his cyber troops into government departments to steal the private information of US citizens and feed it to Grok, among other things. He sent masked men without identification from ICE to snatch people off the streets, take them to concentration camps in the US and foreign prisons. He sent federal troops into Washington, D.C., L.A. and Memphis, he's now thinking about Portland, to exert his power on the streets. Gutted the executive branch of experts, filled it with unqualified loyalists to head agencies, including the FBI, the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, and the military. He's using the Department of Justice to pardon his felon friends and pursue his so-called enemies. In civil society, he has attacked law firms, universities, media organizations. He's taken many measures against women by withdrawing funds for family planning, passing measures which will disproportionately restrict women's voting rights, even ordering the erasure of celebrated women from websites, in fact, all mentions of women of achievement, from websites of organizations including NASA, the Pentagon, and the Arlington Cemetery. He's declared there to be only two genders to delegitimize trans people's very existence. He has ordered the correction of museum exhibitions and school curricula to minimize the harms of slavery and the Jim Crow system, which followed it for 100 years. So it's a lot, but is it fascism? Yeah, Jason.
Well, I mean, in the spring with my then colleague, Robin Dembroff, I taught a course on fascism and patriarchy, and we taught Wilhelm Reich's, among other things, Wilhelm Reich's The Mass Psychology of Fascism. And Wilhelm Reich talks about the Nazi targeting of federal workers and how they targeted federal workers as sort of lazy and living off the state. And that's how they got the urban working class to vote Nazi, because they pitted them. They said the federal workers have a higher social status than you and they're not, they're lazy. And that's exactly the sort of attack on the federal workers that we've seen in the United States. Then they mass fired them, and then they replaced them with loyalists in a process they called Gleichschaltung. So we're seeing Gleichschaltung just point by point in the United States. And so we're seeing so many overlaps here. And then, of course, the ideological overlaps are enormous. The targeting of immigrants, the panic about foreigners that is so distinctive of German fascism. Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf, my study and struggles in Vienna, is all about how the city, Vienna, is crawling with foreigners. We're seeing that city, the rural-urban divide, the cities with black populations are being labeled as criminal and dens of corruption. All of this overlaps with both German fascism as well as the aspects of the United States that the Germans borrowed from us. After all, Hitler in Mein Kampf says the country he most wants Germany to emulate is the United States. And when Trump says he's going to make America great again, he's returning us to that time of the Asian Exclusion Act, the 1924 Immigration Act. Madison Grant's The Passing of the Great Race, his 1916 book that Hitler read in prison. Proud to say Madison Grant was a Yale grad. So we have the ideological preconditions in the United States. We also have, as Toni Morrison and talked about in her 1995 speech, Racism and Fascism. I mean, we have this longstanding police state directed against our national minority. We have the largest prison system in the world. We had that going into this. So I don't know. We had these fascist elements. The way I see it is sort of in classic fascism, you have this construction where colonialism, you know, leads to fascism because what you do to people elsewhere then rebounds in your country. I think in the United States, we've been doing this to Black Americans for a very long time, and there's no reason to think that you can constrain the violation of the rule of law to your national minority.
Masha, are we there? Oh, yes.
Yeah. I think that was quite comprehensive on both of your parts. I think I would add a couple of things. One is we're now seeing people disappeared. There was just a terrific investigation by a Florida newspaper showing that thousands of people who were confined to this concentration camp called Alligator Alcatraz have just vanished. They have vanished from the immigration system rolls. Like, it is actually impossible to locate them bureaucratically or physically. And we also, as you may have read, the secretary of the newly renamed Department of War, which used to be the Department of Defense, is summoning all the generals to some meeting. We have no idea what's going to happen at that meeting. But that sort of spectacle, that performance, and that, you know, this idea that this is a country at war, a country under siege, and it's America against the world, and also the bombing of these Venezuelan boats, I would put in the same category, which it's like what Jason was saying. All of this has a history, right, that precedes Trump. The United States was doing what it wanted in the world for decades before Trump, and ignoring international humanitarian law and the laws of war for decades before Trump. But this twist of demonstratively targeting civilians, demonstratively violating international law, rather than doing it in shame and in secret and pretending that it's something else, that's a fascist term.
Yeah, can I jump? That's absolutely right. That's crucial, this shift to the explicit nature that happened with Jimmy Kimmel, where they were just like, okay, we're going to fire him because we don't like him. They backed up a little, but when they fired Colbert, they pretended it was financial. But with Kimmel, they were just very open. So that shift to the openness of everything, that seems to me quite indicative that there's a shift in, they feel they don't have to pretend anymore, and they're directing hard propaganda against America. So typically in a democracy, you just use soft propaganda. You just try to indoctrinate people. But no, now they're saying, you know, if you disagree with us, we'll hunt you down. And then on the concentration camp point, in Kristallnacht, when Jews were put into concentration camps, the goal was to treat them brutally to get them to self-deport. And this is exactly what they're saying they're doing with these concentration camps. The goal is to get them to self-deport. It's the exact same vocabulary.
So there's a mechanism of fear. So it's attractive to some Trump supporters to feel strong by all of this mistreatment of other people, and then it's also creating fear internally, so it's doing both of those.
Yeah, well, it's always this combination of, you know, we are under threat. There's also, I would add to this fascist vocabulary, the vocabulary of contagion.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yes. Poisoning the blood of the nation.
Yeah, and it's, you know, whether it's social contagion that trans people, you know, are contaging young girls especially, or immigrants, or bringing in drugs, bringing in death, bringing in danger, right?
The contagion point is vital for fascist ideology. Purity is central to fascism. And so contagion is, you know, the opposite of, you know, it's you got that notion of purity, gender purity, racial purity, two sides of the same coin. And so when you hear the contagion, that's just telling you you're supposed to prime purity.
Going through a checklist from the fascist playbook for Trump's America. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, you're joining me, Natasha Mitchell, with scholar and author Jason Stanley, journalist and author M. Gessen, and author Anna Funder, who are with an audience at the Sydney Opera House. Now, let's further unpack some of those specific elements of fascist regimes.
So when you're teaching your class about patriarchy and fascism, I know you've said before in other conversations that we've had that patriarchy is really the ur ideology out of which fascism comes. So in patriarchy, you have an underclass, which is defined by gender. And then in fascism, you might have one defined by race or whatever people are being vilified. I'm wondering, I don't want to create any false hope here, but would gender equality be an anti-fascist measure?
White women are white. And so, as we've discovered in election after election, they keep voting for Trump. So
they're not voting in their own gender interests.
Maybe they're voting in their own. I mean, these are all, so it's a familiar part of American history. Du Bois emphasizes it in Black Reconstruction, that race is a mechanism to divide bodies, you know, to divide the working class for power. Robin Dembroff, my Yale colleague, argues in their forthcoming book that gender is a similar mechanism to divide bodies for power. And I think you couldn't get a better analysis of the current moment with, gender politics being, they're dividing people using gender, you know, with the attack on the scapegoating of trans people being a kind of brainworm along this. I mean, but I think that's what's, it's impossible to, you can't really disaggregate patriarchy and racism, because the idea is, you know, the racial other is threatening our women. So the connection there is Ida B. Wells noted.
The brainworm idea of somehow trans people being threatening to authoritarianism, I mean, I just don't get it. Is there any way that makes any sense in any world apart from Trump world? I mean,
does it make any sense that trans people are a danger to the nation? Well, it's interesting.
Well, to Trump ideas of gender.
I mean, yes, it makes a lot of sense. And it makes a lot of sense in several ways. One is just sort of a direct parallel. Every time I file a column that has to do with trans stuff, somebody well-intentioned and smart on the New York Times editorial staff will try to insert a mention of just how tiny a minority trans people are. And I finally had it, last week, and I said, you know, this is like, what is the point of continually stressing this? Like, we would be a greater danger to the country if we were more than 1% of the population. But, you know, Jews were, what, 0.5%? 0.5% of the German population. So it's very easy to take a minority that is exotic and unknown and make it the scary other. At this point in the United States, this would be much harder to do with gay and lesbian people, because everybody knows a gay or lesbian person, right? So it's much harder to say, you know, your cousin is a threat to the health of the nation. But somebody you've never met, somebody you may never have even seen on TV, or have only seen on TV, that's a credible threat to the nation. So that's one reason why it makes sense. Another reason it makes sense is that gender is the sort of the way that we organize society. Apologies to those who were in the morning session and we talked about a little bit of this. But, you know, every time I leave my house with my dog, like the first person I see in the street will ask me what my dog's gender is and how old my dog is. Because somehow this is important to understanding, right? Like, who my dog is. And it's just the way we put things into categories. And to say, you know, the categories of your life are disordered and we can put them back in order. We can take you back to an imaginary past when things made sense, when women were women and men were men, and you felt secure and you didn't feel dislocated, you didn't feel uprooted, you didn't feel like your future was uncertain. That's very appealing. That makes a lot of sense. And it makes so much sense that it's currently used by autocrats all over the world, this whole idea of gender ideology. And this is the third point I'm going to make about why gender this idea of gender ideology works so well. And it has to do with the sense of dislocation, that there's nothing that any of us fears more than being estranged from our children. And sort of saying, look, this is, we understand. And again, this completely echoes Nazi ideology, right? The Jews are after your children. And now the trans people are after your children. Your child is going to go to school. This is something that Trump actually said on the campaign trail. Your child is going to go to school and come back having had gender reassignment surgery. And that makes sense in this world of fear of not knowing your children.
Masha, one of your brilliant op-ed pieces recently was captioned, "Welcome to Trump's Mafia State." And it had one of the best subheadings I've ever seen, which was a quote from your piece. "Nice university you got there. Shame if something happened to it." We've watched Columbia capitulate to shakedown tactics. The universities, Trump is trying to pick them off one by one. Harvard stood up to it. I'm wondering what the future holds for America's fantastic universities in this environment.
I think Trump has a couple of political talents. And one of his true talents, like that's like unlike anything I've ever seen in my work before, is his nose for hypocrisy. When he sees a gap between what people or organizations say they are and what they really are, he inserts his politics right into that gap. And he's able to cleave the institutions from one another and from themselves. And I think that that's what's really happening with American universities. American universities claim that they're institutions created for the production and dissemination of knowledge. But wealthy American universities work as hospitality businesses with a little bit of educational entertainment on the side and hedge funds, right?
Yeah.
And so he goes after their money and says, if you want to keep your money, you're going to have to sacrifice this little sideline you have in knowledge production and dissemination. And universities say, okay. And it's interesting, when I wrote that column back in the spring that said, the only way that universities can fight this is to act like universities, to open up, to start offering their, and there are a couple of good examples, actually, of universities that do this, start offering their courses, their whatever they can offer, to as wide a public as possible, and to spend their endowments in this. I started getting letters from people saying, you don't understand how universities work. You can't just spend the endowment, because then you won't have an endowment. Like, well, do you want a university to go with your endowment? Or do you just want to keep the endowment? And I think the answer is most universities just want to keep the endowment.
Well, it's a little unfair, Masha. I'm a man of the people. I went to a state university, but I did spend a lot of my career in these super wealthy universities, and they can't spend their endowment because it's tied up, and rich people will give their money to, build a building to put their name on it. And so much of Yale's money is not liquid. But, I absolutely agree with you on a bunch of your points, but there are these obstacles to simply handing the government a ton of cash. And they're also asking $1 billion from UCLA. So UCLA does educate a ton of people. It's
charging them almost as much as the Ivies charge them.
Not for California. Anyway, let's not.
Right, okay.
I have another question for you, Jason. I want to get into your book, Erasing History, which is so magnificent. I can't recommend it enough. I think it's the best analysis, absolutely magnificent, about the uses that history has put to, or the misuses. You write in that book, one lesson the past century taught us is that authoritarian regimes often find history profoundly threatening. At every opportunity, these regimes find ways of erasing or concealing history in order to consolidate their power. So there are obviously lots of problems with universities coddling their endowments. But another thing that they do is write history from below, from different points of view, new sorts of history, which the Trump administration doesn't want to happen. Can you comment on that? Why is it that history is so disruptive as a intellectual activity in more generally to fascist politics?
It depends. I mean, there are ways of presenting history where it's not disruptive. As Hitler's very vivid about this in Mein Kampf. He says, you know, Germans have lost the art of teaching history as the exploits of great Aryan men. So if you teach history as just the exploits of great men of the nation, like in India, they're trying to rewrite the history books this way, then you make you remove agency from normal people. You make normal people think that the only people who can change anything are great men. And so when I think about my own education, my history books didn't have any women in them. It was like, wow, so many millennia and women did nothing. So that was already, we already had these ideological preconditions. In the United States, you already had an exceptionalist narrative in the history books. You already had this sort of mythology of the founding fathers. In the small literature on Nazi education, they say that Weimar Germany, the history was already very exceptionalist and German nationalist, and so the Nazis didn't actually have to do much. And you can see that in our textbooks in the United States. They're already saying the United States is the greatest nation in history. They're already saying that we're immune to fascism. They're already presenting it as like the founders were these great men, and then you add Martin Luther King because he's the one non-white man, and you throw him in, but can then say he ended racism.
Trump has just taken his bust out of the Oval Office.
Yeah, well, you know.
So that's sending a signal.
Right. There's many signals, like the only refugees allowed in are white Afrikaners. If when you present, the philosophy of education is all about democratic education, is all about giving ordinary citizens in a democracy agency. And the way of producing history, first, so it leans into the kind of past that Masha was discussing, a mythic, great, pure past. And secondly, you know, just say history is just the exploits of great men is an anti-democratic, is a way to attack democracy via the textbooks.
Can I just add a little bit to that? Because a lot of my work was thinking and writing about Russia trying to recover from 70 years of totalitarianism. And what I realized was that recovery was hampered and possibly made it impossible by the net loss of knowledge, right? By just the systematic destruction of all the tools of self-understanding that Russian society had and the societies that Russia had colonized had. And I think that that's part of the project. It's not just erasing history to erase particular groups and particular sets of facts. It's also confusing the record and robbing us of language and understanding that would allow us to make sense of what's happening to us now and what will happen to us in the future.
You wrote terrifyingly about, in the 1970s, Soviet historians, sociologists, had fewer tools to understand the world than they had in the 1920s. So there was this catastrophic dumbing down and disenfranchisement of people because of that. Yes,
exactly. Yes. And you read my book.
I read all your books. It's like I've done my homework.
Yes, plenty of brilliant, insightful reads from today's discussion with Russian-American journalist and author M. Gessen, American scholar and author Jason Stanley, and asking the questions is Australian author Anna Funder at the Sydney Opera House, And we'll link to all of their books in our show notes. Now, they're exploring the first year of Donald Trump's second term as US president, a tumultuous year, and the similarities and the differences with fascist and authoritarian regimes throughout history. Back now to Anna.
We are talking a lot about parallels between the rise of fascism in the 1930s and now, for obvious reasons. But one of the very big differences, I think, I mean, I might be wrong, is our technologically connected and surveilled age now. So when I was looking at a photograph of the tech bros lined up again in front of Trump at his inauguration, so Bezos, Zuckerberg, Musk, Tim Cook of Apple and Sundar Pichai of Google, it was very hard for a moment to tell who was in whose pocket, who was toadying to whom. The former Guardian journalist Carol Cadwalader has talked about this as Putin's playbook, allowing the business elite to make untold fortunes in exchange for absolute loyalty. But she writes that those fortunes are made in a way by destroying our privacy in a way that the Stasi could only have dreamed of. She says that the entire business model of Silicon Valley is surveillance, and we are already living in the architecture of totalitarianism. I'm wondering if you guys could help shed some light on what that's going to mean for the situation in the US now. What are the ramifications of that for people?
Yeah, I think it's a great parallel, actually, to Putin's Russia. Although I would argue that this is not a point of contrast between the 1930s and now. I think that... thank you, Jason. I think that
Hitler did
you know what made the Holocaust possible was the industrialization. It was a genocide that happened in the industrial age. It was on rails. It was it had an entire architecture and system that it couldn't have had before. And so, I mean, there's a great book by Zygmunt Bauman that talks about the Holocaust being a function of modernity, right? And I think that it's useful to think of the surveillance state which already exists, or the surveillance architecture that already exists, as the same kind of enabling structure. And also, we don't have to go very far into the future, because that kind of surveillance technology is already being used to perpetrate genocide in Gaza. Right. And it also means that these tech companies are greatly invested in the genocide in Gaza, as Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur's report, has laid out. But to the parallel with Putin, you know, one of the first things that Putin did was he gathered oligarchs, which means people who had parlayed their financial power into political power, into more financial power. And he said, okay, if you want to keep your financial power, you have to forfeit your political power. And I think that what I saw at Trump's inauguration was that same bargain. Anybody who agrees to forfeit their political power in exchange for keeping their fortunes will become wealthier. Everybody else will become less wealthy or will be politically persecuted.
Those men are already so wealthy. Were you surprised that they had no backbone? I mean, how wealthy do you have to be before you stand up to someone like Trump?
I lived in Russia. So I was not surprised for 1 second. I wasn't surprised when Jeff Bezos, who, if the entire Washington Post vanished tomorrow, it would not make 0.5% of difference to Bezos' fortune. And yet, he basically sacrificed his editorial page to Trump.
The personal liberties and free markets.
I'm interested in inequality. I'm interested a little bit in the material conditions of life in the US and how that contributes to fascism, because it certainly was a factor that played into the German rise of fascism. Often you hear people say America is the richest country in the world, but it really, I think, doesn't matter so much to ordinary people how many billionaires there are in your country who are not paying tax. It's about the level of income inequality, and the US is the most unequal of or unfair in terms of income distribution of all developed countries. There are 40 million people living in the US in poverty. And one of the aspects of that poverty is healthcare poverty. It is very hard for Australians, it has been hard for me, to understand why Americans consistently vote against the expansion of government-funded healthcare to people. And it was something that I read of yours about the great historian W.E.B. Du Bois writing that really helped me understand that. I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little.
Jonathan Metzl's book, Dying of Whiteness, is great on this, where he goes around and he looks at, say, Medicaid expansion and why people in Tennessee and West Virginia, very few black people in West Virginia, why they're so against Medicaid expansion when it benefits them. And it's because they essentially think that Medicaid would go to the three black people in West Virginia. So, you know, the United States, and that's why Canada is safe to some extent, because Canada defines itself against the United States. So Canada is like one of the most, is a genuine multiracial democracy. But the United States, again and again, you're going back to this thing that Du Bois's Black Reconstruction is about, where the wealthy are using race as a way to split the working class for power. And now I think, as Robin Dembroff is saying, we see that with gender very explicitly as well, with poor men, white men, voting against their self-interests. So that's essential to understand. Race is just utterly essential to understand the United States. It's very mysterious if you don't understand the role of slavery and its aftermath. You don't understand why people are consistently voting against their economic self-interest. And this is something that MAGA knows. In the Errol Morris documentary on Steve Bannon, Bannon says the Democrats think that people care about living longer. The Democrats think people care about healthcare. They don't. They just want to see the people they hate suffer.
It's incredible. It blew my mind to be understanding that. And it was particularly Du Bois's concept of the wages of whiteness. Same. If you're a poor white and you're a poor black person, so he's writing in the 30s, right?
1935.
You can explain this better than
yeah, so the psychological way he's trying to explain. So the story is a labor movement was developing. Poor whites and poor blacks were starting to unify in a labor movement. And many poor whites refused to fight on the side of the South. The general strike, they were like, well, we don't benefit from slavery. So there was sort of an effort then to really give poor whites a slight leg up over poor blacks, to tell them, well, at least you're not black. And so you should side with rich whites because, you know, at least you're not black. So this method, and you can see this ideology with Hitler's attack on unions as well in Mein Kampf, because he says, look, why does Hitler hate unions? He says they're unifying people on the basis of class, whereas people should be unified on the basis of race. So this is exactly what Du Bois is talking about. That's why unions and the labor movement are such key anti-fascist organizations, because they unify people around material politics. And fascism appeals to racial politics, gender politics, non-material politics. Democracy, a healthy democracy, is one where people are thinking about, healthcare.
Let me just, I just want to add a little bit to what Jason said. There's also a terrific book by Heather McGee called Some of Us.
Some of Us.
Which one of the stories she tells in the book is the story of the disappearance of public pools in the United States.
Right.
Which after the Supreme Court ordered desegregation, it became illegal to have segregated public pools. So cities, one after another, closed their public pools rather than desegregate them.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure the Germans have a word for it. It's like a Schadenfreude, but magnified. I want to ask a question about pushback in the US. What are you feeling? Is there any? Where is it coming from? Is it unified? Is it unions? Is it universities? Is it generational? Masha, is there any significant? We're looking for it from the Democrats. We're not seeing it. Where is it coming from? Where does it need to come from?
So where is pushback coming from? It's not coming from institutions. And it's not, you know, whether that institution is a political party or a university or a law firm or some sort of professional association. And it's not coming from institutions for reasons that can be explained, right? I think universities and law firms and media corporations are caving in ways that are consistent with their corporate values or in their institutional values. Universities and corporations are trying to maintain jobs, maintain funding, make a profit for their shareholders if they're publicly traded corporations. They, you know, and so not only are they not, is there no motivation for them to resist, but in fact, they can feel good, individuals making those decisions can feel good about themselves because they're acting in ways that are consistent with their values and with the expectations of their social media. So if there's going to be effective resistance and widespread resistance, it's going to be non-institutional. We have seen large protests, extremely large protests, right? No King's Day in July, I think it was the biggest protest in US history. In order for that kind of protest to have an impact, it has to be even bigger and it has to be sustained. Is that going to happen? We have no way of knowing because institutional media, and I work for institutional media, does not, I'm not even going to say that, like, you know, I don't think that the New York Times is somehow politically motivated not to be documenting that kind of resistance. It's just not designed for that. And it will take much longer for an institution as large and with as strong an institutional culture to reorient itself than we actually have time.
So looking into the future, is there going to be another election, another free and fair election?
So we were just talking backstage about how much I hate the term competitive authoritarianism.
I'll tell my colleague who invented it.
Great, thanks. I need more enemies, Jason. So competitive authoritarianism, it describes something that is necessary to describe, which is most contemporary autocracies look on the surface like democracies. Because they perform the rituals of democracies like elections, and they have legislatures, and the legislatures discuss bills and vote, right? But these legislatures are actually rubber stamping bodies, and the elections are not actually competitive, which is why I hate the term competitive authoritarianism. And what makes the elections not competitive is restrictions on access to the vote, restrictions on access to the media, and attacks on political opponents before they can gather enough traction to actually be able to participate in elections. All of that is happening in the United States now. So to imagine that we're going to have meaningful elections, even in 2026, never mind 2028, I think is a little crazy.
Do you agree?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think it's my only question is how your newspaper consistently writes as if everything's normal and, oh, we have three more years of this. Like, what? As a philosopher, what interests me is the capacity for denial that we're seeing, which is really the philosophical question. You know, I mean, the idea that Trump would step down from office, given what happened in 2020, seems absurd. And yet, you know, our paper of note writes just with regularity about the assumption that this is his last term.
Yes, it's a fantasy. Jason, we look at the U.S. and we, like, 65% of people voted in the last election to vote Trump in. Here we have what's called compulsory voting, which is universal voting. So everybody votes at every level. We have a representative ballot system and we have caps on political donations. So corporations can't effectively buy a politician to represent their interests. And the backbone of social justice here is Medicare. You recently wrote in The Guardian that you think Australia is next, that fascism is rolling out around the world and Australia will probably be next. I feel like, just going back to that material question about inequality of income and access to healthcare, I don't know. I feel I'm hoping that those things, we have those elements here, but I'm hoping those things are protective. Am I in denial?
Well, we spend a lot of time in talking about the material conditions for fascism, the background material conditions, which are inequality. But we don't spend enough time talking about the ideological preconditions for fascism. And I think ideological preconditions are really important. I mean, after all, Biden dumped more money into the poor white working class than anyone since FDR, and it didn't work at all. So the ideological preconditions are really essential here. I mean, you know, we say, okay, you know, fascism arose because of Bolshevism, and Bolshevism really was a terrifying existential threat in the 1930s. Wokeism, I don't think, is Bolshevism. I don't think, you know, so there's this ideological, the global attack, the global fascist wave works via this sort of vilification of wokeism, this representation of gender ideology, of racial equality as some kind of Bolshevism. And it somehow seems to work as an ideological mechanism. And so all the things we knew about, we thought we knew about fascism, you needed violent communists. No, actually, you know, you just need people asking that you use the right pronouns and then you can get fascism rolling. You know, I see that we have these ideological preconditions, and then those ideological preconditions are strengthened by the kind of concerned liberals who are constantly whinging on and on about wokeism as if it's so. But you see, like in Russia, you know, the Gay Propaganda Act, like all these things where it was generated, as Masha has documented, by this ideological thing about, you know, cultural Marxism. And that seems shockingly to be as powerful as other factors.
It might also be here that mentioning Trump is quite powerful, not perhaps as powerful as mentioning Bolshevism, but during our election campaign, a liberal politician uttered the words, "Make Australia great again." And the specter of Trumpism sunk that party's chances in the election.
That happened in Canada.
We feel we feel good about that.
But, you know, I think that the psychological preconditions are more important than the ideological or the material. But as Eric Fromm wrote in Escape from Freedom, there come moments in human history when enough people feel anxious enough about the future to want to hand over their agency and all the power to an autocrat. And the great service that wokeism and pronouns do for us is, you know, they keep us from talking about climate change, which we can stop using they/them pronouns. We can't do anything about climate change. We can't do anything about in the United States. Certainly, when you mentioned the inequality, inequality is very important. But I think it's the anxiety. It's the number. It's not even the 40 million people living in poverty, but it's the much greater number of people. It's the majority of Americans feeling living in anxiety, in paycheck to paycheck anxiety, in sort of, you know, lack of retirement funds anxiety, in I can't quit my job because I will have no health insurance anxiety. And that anxiety is very well addressed by clear and stupid ideas.
Thank you both so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
And what is in store for Trump's America in 2026 and the world with it? With an audience hanging there on every word at this Sydney Opera House event, you heard from Russian-American journalist, opinion writer and author M. Gessen, American scholar and author Jason Stanley, and author Anna Funder. Big thanks to the Opera House team and to our big thinkers today. And you can get in touch with us here at ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. I love hearing from you. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. It's an easy one to remember. Next time, something different again. Does Australia's history unite or divide us? Six leading scholars go head to head in the annual Great Debate from the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. That's next on the show. I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.